by Mutos, Dregs, Primords, Field Major Styre of the Sontaran Empire, and the bandaged-faced Traffic Warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels, alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, though you're only linked to the past, maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics, brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Picking forlornly at his radiation-burned skin as the last of the pain meds runs out this week is Gary Russell. Surely one of the best-known people in Doctor Who fandom, Gary was a child actor, appearing in BBC 1970s classics The Phoenix and the Carpet, and most famously, as Dick in The Famous Five. As well as countless other non-Doctor Who projects, books and dramas, Gary has worked on perhaps more roles linked to Doctor Who than anyone else in the show's history. As a writer, he was editor of Doctor Who magazine in the early 1990s and has penned several Doctor Who novels for Virgin Publishing and BBC Books, including his latest, a novelisation of the first 14th Doctor adventure, The Star Beast. With Jason Haigh-Ellery, he co-founded Big Finish in 1998 and was producer, writer and director there until 2006. When Doctor Who returned in 2005, Gary was part of Russell T Davies' team and he worked as script editor on the main show, as well as The Sarah Jane Adventures and Torchwood. In addition, he's produced and co-directed several of the Doctor Who animations and, perhaps most pertinently, for a podcast sponsored by Cutaway Comics, Gary has written several Doctor Who comics for Doctor Who Magazine and IDW, and currently for us, of which more later. Gary, welcome to The Bunker.
Thank you. It's nice and sheltered in here.
It is. It's cold.
Has it been built to withstand nuclear war or the Armageddon of 1,000 Daleks coming in, or to keep the weather out?
Well, I guess you do one and you definitely do the latter.
I suppose so.
Yeah, it keeps too much weather out, like in Threads where they all suffocate. Anyway.
Thank you for that nice potpourri of my career. That's quite scary, really.
I've had to write quite a few of these, and that was by far the hardest distillation, because you have done so much, Gary. It's crazy.
Yeah, but none of it's any good.
Lots of it is amazing and very good, as you well know. You're very self-deprecating, Gary, is one word.
It's just it's all crap. Yeah, everything well, I mean, touch burns.
As you know, I'd love to write a biography of your Who work alone.
Just I know you would. It's not going to happen.
I know, because you
no.
You don't want people thinking you're a big head. But
that's right.
But fair enough. But I understand. Is it right that you're writing your sort of acting memoir of your?
I've been on and off this for over 10 years now. Sort of doing it started off as wanting to do a book about the Famous Five. And then I thought, actually, if I stretch it so it's like a decade of my life as a child actor, so it can encompass Phoenix and the Carpet and Dark Towers and a couple of other things, might have a little bit more appeal. But it really is a case of there's a file sitting on my desktop. Hello, file. I'm looking at you at the moment, which I last touched on the 17th of July, 2018, according to the little code it's got on it. And I first started it in about 2011. So you can see that I'm not exactly good at meeting self-imposed deadlines. And then what it was originally going to be with Hearst Books, and then when Hearst Books folded, that kind of took away the impetus for me to actually get it done. And I've got another publisher who wants to do it and has very kindly said to me, we'll publish it when you've written it, which is very good sense from their point of view, but not really very useful from mine, because I do work much better at the deadline. But I need to do it to get it out of my system, really.
Oh, well, I'll certainly buy a copy. It's fascinating.
Yay, 2 copies sold. You and my mum.
I remember watching Phoenix and the Carpet as a very young child while you were in it. I absolutely loved that. It's one of my, apart from Doctor Who, it's one of my earliest memories, that show.
Aww.
It's brilliant. I don't ever remember The Famous Five for some reason. Was it on ITV?
ITV, yes. We were BBC
Channel. My dad worked for ABC.
We don't watch ITV in our house.
Yeah, it was very much like that. My dad worked for the BBC, and we didn't, and they were very much, you don't want to expose children to adverts.
That's right.
Kind of the early 70s kind of mentality.
Yes.
Stick to auntie kind of thing. I mean, doing this podcast, your name has come up more than anybody else's as sort of part of people's careers, and quite often, as with Joe Lidster, he's, you know, very much the first step on their careers, or, you know, and it's just integral, and including myself. And I've said this to you, so apologies. And I've probably said it on this podcast a few times, so I'm going to say it now, this little story, and then never say it again. But basically, when I was a student, I sort of had dreadlocks and smoked dope and drank too much, but also had this little secret. I'm a Doctor Who fan, and inspired by the fact that Paul Cornell went to my university and had just graduated, right? My creative writing tutor said, oh, you should look at these Virgin New Adventures books, because Paul Cornell's written some of them. So that got me into those. And then I was secretly writing Doctor Who. But one of the first things I did was start buying Doctor Who magazine again, just as you'd become editor, I think. And so I wrote a brief encounter called Graves, and I sent it off to you. And then I had a letter back from you saying you'd like to publish it. And I was absolutely, I was 19. I was like, yes, I'm going to be a world famous novelist from this moment onwards, because someone has said they want to actually publish my writing, which is amazing. But then that day, Paul Cornell came in to the university to give a little talk to us as undergraduates. And I showed him your letter. And then I asked him, how do I get paid for this? And he said, well, you have to send him an invoice. And I said, what's an invoice? Because I was so green. And so because of Paul Cornell, I wrote my first invoice to you, and got 40 quid from UK Marvel, with the Hulk on one side and Spider-Man on the other, which as a 19-year-old geek was pretty good. But then what's weird is the story never got published, as we've established in the bar various times, because actually the continuity of my story was rubbish, because I had Ace not knowing who the Brigadier was and things like that. So I got paid by your good self for a story that actually was never published, and I don't have a copy of it. So
I think that's the best way around.
Yeah, it's lost to history.
But you got paid, and you know, that's quite an achievement from Marvel, I can tell you, to be paid for something that never got published. That was pretty good going.
Yeah, looking back, it was so weird. But yeah, I've got a photocopy of the check. Unfortunately, unlike Christian Slater and his check from Star Trek, I was never rich enough to not cash the check. But I did photocopy it. I did photocopy it.
And, but you didn't photocopy the actual story?
No, I don't think so. It's one of those things that it might turn up yet. But back then I was writing on an Amstrad with discs, and I got burgled a lot because I lived in Leeds after I lived in Crewe. And so just it really, I look back and it really did affect my early attempts to become a writer, you know, because they'd literally steal my new adventure that I was in the middle of writing, and I couldn't afford a printer. So I just lost everything of copies, and, you know, I was living in absolute poverty with Nail and I style life while trying to write Doctor Who things and various other things. It was hard.
I think we've all been there at some point.
It was hard those part of the 90s. It really was. But anyway, we're not here to talk about me. Just thought I'd get that out of my system. So Doctor Who, that wonderful thing that has taken over all our lives for one to one degree or another. I mean, we're here to sort of look back to your earliest years. I mean, you becoming when did you get your first acting gig? Were you like five?
No, I was. Well, it was 1975, because it meant that I didn't get to see things like Pyramids of Mars and Planet of Evil and the Android Invasion very well, because I was away working. So that was my first professional actual work. Would have been the summer of 75.
And so you were 12.
That was a theatre show. That was a theatre tour. And then Fiends on the Carpet followed at the end of 76. And then Famous Five was straight after Fiends on the Carpet. It will take a couple of months. And then that sort of kept me ticking over until late 70s, early 80s dried up. And I went, I'll give up on that.
But how much do you put you becoming an actor down to you loving Doctor Who?
Oh, 100%.
So 100%, yeah.
Oh, 100%. Everything in my life that I've done is because of my love of Doctor Who. I mean, it's quite tragic, really. Everything I've done has come from Doctor Who. Yeah, no, I wanted to be an actor because I watched Doctor Who and thought that looks great. I mean, I wanted to be a stuntman originally because I thought stuntmen had great fun.
Stuart
and that
Fell.
Used to terrify my mum to pieces. And so she sent me to 1 hour a week acting class to try and knock it out of my system, and that didn't really work. No, I mean, I was watching television as a kid. That first generation that, you know, TV was there and was an art form and was on, and there was a BBC One and a BBC Two and an ITV and lots of things to watch. And I rapaciously adored television, and I used to read the Radio Times and the TV Times from cover to cover, all these programmes that I could never watch because they went out late at night, but I used to learn the names of all the actors, and I used to learn the names of all the programmes and look at all the pictures, and it was great. And then, you know, it's also Lookin' came along, and I used to read Lookin' and love Lookin' and read picture strips of TV shows I'd never seen. And it was brilliant. And so all of this was feeding my need and my passion to be an actor, and it did.
Yeah, and very successfully as well. I mean, it's no...
Well, let's not go mad. I had a successful couple of years as a kid, really. Phoenix and the Two of the Famous Five and Dark Towns, I think, would be considered a nice, successful career for a child actor. But like most child actors, I didn't transition into being a grown-up actor.
Did you ever audition for Grange Hill?
No, I auditioned for Brookside once.
Oh.
And that was it. That was the end of my career, actually, was auditioning for Brookside.
So that was 82, wasn't it? That
was 82, and I was told that I was too posh, and I had no future on British television by being posh.
Bastards.
So I thought, well, these people must know what they're talking about. So I gave up, went home and said, "Mum, so that's it, not doing this anymore." A proper job at the BBC.
That's amazing.
January 83, and that was that.
What was the proper job?
I was working in the radio script unit, which meant... We're at a period, right? So everything's on typewriters. Word processors haven't been invented. And we're working at a point where most Radio 2 and a lot of Radio 4 programs, the scripts for them were written by hand, usually by the presenters or sometimes the contributors and occasionally by the producers. So they would come down to us. Our job was to file and keep them and keep an index and all of this sort of stuff. But these scripts would come in and we would have to type them up so they could be kept for posterity and then microfiched and everything else, because you couldn't microfiche handwriting because it would just be illegible in 20 years' time. So I spent a year and a half in this script library at the Langham, and that was part of the BBC buildings. And so that's what I was doing for a couple of years, 18 months, I think. And then I moved over to TV and went to work in the TV Centre press office. And I stayed there for many years, going up through the ranks in there, and then ended up in picture publicity. And then one day just went, "I've had enough of the BBC. I've been here 8 years. Thank you very much. I want to go and do something else." So I left and went freelance. Then DWM happened about a year and a half later. I was there for 3 years nearly, and I got fired. And then I stayed in magazines for a few years, and I was still freelancing on and off as well, writing books and things. And then Big Finish happened, and that was that, really.
Yeah. Well, we'll get on to all that in due course, but your first choice for The Bunker takes us all the way back to...
First choice for The Bunker takes us back, not to the start of me watching Doctor Who, because that would be the regeneration of Hartnell and Stratton, but the point at which I think I knew I was addicted. Pertwee had come in, and Doctor Who was thrilling and exciting and brilliant and amazing. And there was this story on television called Inferno, which involved a parallel universe version of Earth. And that triggered something in me that has never left me, which is this idea of the what-ifs and the alternate universes and alternate versions of characters. And there was a period on TV, there was this, and I think shortly before that, we'd had a couple of Star Trek episodes. There was one where there was two versions of Kirk, and there was another one where there was a guy that was jumping between universes, and there were two versions of him. And there was a brilliant episode of Lost in Space called The Antimatter Man, where these evil duplicates of John Robinson and Don West broke through into our universe, and the robot as well. It was an evil version of the robot. And I loved that. I just thought that was fantastic. So when Doctor Who did it with Inferno, I was completely hooked. I just love the alternative everything, whether it's alternative realities, alternative histories. I love seeing different takes on familiar things. because it means you can open them up. And Inferno, just every single week. I mean, as I would have been seven, I suppose, at that point, six even. And it seemed to run forever. And I really didn't know where the Silurian story and the Ambassador story and the Parallel World story, because I didn't know what the individual story titles were in those days. I wasn't sure where they'd ended. To me, it all seemed to be one long, continuous Doctor Who story that went on for the entire year. The fact that I learned, you know, many years later, it was actually the shortest season of Doctor Who ever at that point. And it's like, no. It ran all year round. Doctor Who was, John Pertwee was there every week. And I was just absolutely hooked. And of course, it starts with the Autons, which was just brilliant. Season 7 of Doctor Who was then and has remained to this very day the absolute pinnacle of the show for me. There isn't a beat wrong in all of those episodes. They're just perfect Doctor Who. And Inferno is the top of it by default of having a parallel universe in it. But Silurians and Spearhead and Ambassadors are equally all brilliant. It's just perfect. If ever I want comfort Doctor Who from Pertwee's era, that's where I go to, one of those seven parters particularly.
It is amazing. I absolutely love that. Because that's Pertwee's probably the first one I discovered, because I don't remember him, but he was probably the first one I discovered, like, as a more grown-up fan, and fell in love with him after, second to Tom kind of thing. So he's been there almost as long as I can remember as well. But obviously Inferno, we're here with Cutaway Comics, and you're now writing Inferno related material for us.
Well, so this came about because I was talking to Gareth, and he was saying, we want you to do something for Cutaway, and I can't remember whether he said, I'm going to go after Don Horton's estate, or whether I said, let's do something in the, do you think you can get it? Because it would be good to do something with Inferno. I think it probably came from Gareth, but I think he probably knew of my, some would say passion, others would say obsession, with Inferno. And so he offered it to me, and we were able to throw in all the Mind of Evil stuff as well. And it just sung to me, because Mind of Evil is the season 7 story that never was. You know, it's there in season 8. But it sticks out like a sore thumb because it is made and shot and written like it's a season 7 story and should be part of season 7, frankly. And so, yes, to have the opportunity to play with both those universes and combine them into this alternative reality of what happened next was just too good to pass over. And I think if someone else had done it, I would have to have gone out and murdered them. So it was easier to save me from a life of prison for Gareth to say, go on then, go ahead and do this Inferno project. And it's a big, right from the beginning, he said, it's going to be a big sprawling project. This is not, you know, one small little four-part miniseries. This is going to be four or five four-part miniseries. And then there's been all the changes, and we've gone down to the lovely prestige format, which I much prefer. So everything is two-part stories rather than two-issue things rather than four-issue things. And then I'd written this prelude, which was intended originally as part of the Kickstarter. And it was only meant to be about 10 pages long. And then I delivered this thing that was a full comic because I think I'd misunderstood completely what Gareth said. Or maybe something inside me went, I have not misunderstood. I'm just going to make him regret this. So I wrote a full 24-page issue. And in conversations with that, he said, well, yeah, this is kind of there, but it's not really. Do you think you could put a couple more pages at the front to give us the whole sort of alternate storyline from the 1940s onwards? And I said, no, I can give you another 24-page comic if you want. That's that. And so suddenly we have this prestige thing that, instead of being two little promo pieces for the Kickstarter, became a full 50-page in the end, because, you know, I like pushing my limits. So it's 50-page long, one shot, that is everything that takes us from middle of the war, with Oswald Mosley in our reality now claiming dominance, and takes us right up to the night before Pertwee's Doctor arrives in Inferno, in the Inferno universe. So it's right up to the point where Stahlman, you know, in Inferno, he's wearing the gloves and he's wearing the glasses. Mm-hmm. And the Doctor says at one point, you know, you should take the gloves off, and he refuses. And we see what leads up to him needing to wear the glasses and wear the gloves.
Right.
He touches the green, as I call it.
What I've read of it, it's just it's going to be cuts away going from strength to strength.
Oh God, yes! I mean, what a lovely company.
With your stuff, and, you know, with Steve Gallagher's Faustine, we've just gone, oh my God, everything is, you know, it's every publication is a step forward, and it's
I read Faustine the other day. I thought it was marvellous.
The DNA of Doctor Who, the Philip Hinchcliffe years, edited by Gary Russell.
Doing this book with Philip Hinchcliffe, I'm editing it, but the idea spurred on originally from Philip.
It's a collection of essays. Each one is on one of my stories, and it'll be opinions, views, maybe critical opinions. I've spoken to people, well, over many hours, so they've kind of got my views on things now as much as I can remember it, but I think there'll be a lot of new stuff in it.
Everyone's individual essays are very unique and very different, and then each of them is prefaced by a little piece by Philip, and these things have been absolute joys as they come in, because they're not what we expected, they're so much better.
I recorded my thoughts about the programme a long time ago, and fortunately still had those, so they have provided, you know, background for a lot of the writers.
He's almost answering the previous 30 years worth of articles and reviews that have been written. It's, again, it's interesting because it's all new material and it's stuff Philip hasn't said before.
It's going to be a different kind of book that's been written, I think, about Doctor Who.
Classic Doctor Who, new perspectives. From Roundel Books and Cutaway Comics, out in August 2024. See cutawaycomics.co.uk for more details. So I was going to take you back to one of your choices being the 1969 Doctor Who annual.
Yes.
Which I presume is Christmas 68. Did you get it? Shocking?
Well, no, it's not. You see, this is it. I didn't get it. I didn't get the Doctor Who 1969 annual. For probably a poet, it was already the Doctor by then. I think it was given to me by someone. I don't remember, but I think it was given to me by someone because they knew I liked Doctor Who, and I think they'd seen it. So they went, oh, there's a Doctor Who annual. And suddenly my eyes were open. Obviously, I knew who Trant was, and I knew who Jamie was, and I knew what Sidemen were. But my mind was open to Ben and Polly, and the Victoria was in it as well, and there was Polly and Victoria, I think, in one story, and my brain didn't cope with that at all. I thought, well, that's not real. But this annual, just it made me then want to have every single Doctor Who annual there had ever been, because this was something I didn't know existed. This was opening my mind up to the reality that other than a couple of badges given over sugar smacks, there was more to Doctor Who than just the TV show, because this is before Target. This is before the Piccolo making of. And this was a book I could hold in my hands with the word Doctor Who on it. And it had pictures of Doctor Who in it. And it had robots that fell apart into cogs. And it had little worlds living inside drops of tears. And I just read it over and over and over again. I used to go to bed every night and read the same stories over and over again, because I was just going, this is amazing, absolutely fantastic. I could read Doctor Who. I'd read comic strips of Doctor Who. I'd obviously seen Doctor Who in the TV comic strips. And shortly after I got this annual, I think Countdown TV Action, sort of that era started. Because I didn't like the TV comic strips at all. Never did. I never read them with Hartnell, obviously. But I remember reading some of the Trant ones and thinking they were dreadful, thinking they were absolute juvenile rubbish with the wrong Cybermen in them. That's just not acceptable. But this annual felt like real Doctor Who to me. I believed I could have seen these stories on television if I really, you know, screwed my eyes up and thought about it. And the cover is just absolutely inspiring. It's just brilliant picture of Patrick Troughton in a red TARDIS, as you do, holding Jamie back from attacking a Cyberman that's bursting through the TARDIS doors. And I just thought that was fantastic. And it was only about 20, 30 years later I realised that Walt Houghton ripped it off unashamedly from an issue of a Gold Key Lost in Space comic, which probably came out about a month before he painted this. Obviously, he was thinking Gold Key Lost in Space, that's never going to... No, it was Space Family Robinson. No, it's a Space Family. I'm talking about Space Family Robinson. He obviously thought, well, that's never going to make it to the UK. No one will ever spot it. Little realising that one day the internet would happen and we'd all be going, ah, you ripped that off. But it doesn't matter, because it is the most astonishing piece of artwork. And then on the back, I was equally inspired. I knew what the Cybermen were because I love Cybermen, and I knew what the Yeti were, but I had no recollection of the Cyberman with the brain case And I remember talking to people at school about this and going, has that ever been in Doctor Who? It's on the back of the annual, therefore it must have been in Doctor Who. And one of my friends going, yeah, don't you remember? There's that one where they went to the tomb of the Cybermen. I don't think he said tomb of the Cybermen. He probably said the home of the Cybermen. And the guy in charge had a big brain. And I had vague memories of that. I was thinking, oh, yes, of course, that's what that looked like. And suddenly that image and thinking about it and thinking back to those stories I'd watched on a crackly old black and white TV, barely taking it in from week to week, because you didn't when you were a kid. You watched Doctor Who for 25 minutes. You don't really remember it. You don't retain it. I don't think I retained Doctor Who until well into the Pertwee era. But that brought back, and suddenly I was in, again, it was just triggering me, going, I must find out more about Doctor Who. We must find, where can we find more pictures from Doctor Who? And it would, of course, be many, many years before. I mean, the Piccolo book did quite well. But the best thing really for really kicking off memories is the Radio Times 10th anniversary special. And when that came out, that was like everybody at school's Bible. We
That's
all
my
had
equivalent of your 1969 annual, because I was too young, but I was a few years after it. I was given it by my cousin who was older, along with all his 2000 ADs. I got a tea chest full of things that basically created and formed my brain. But yeah, that one with Pertwee on the front, and it's got the Sea Devil, the Cybermen, and the Dalek on the back in a sort of sandpit. And yeah, I poured through that every single. I've got it. All the story titles of all and descriptions.
I could sit down and draw for you if I could draw, but I can't. But I could draw for you the layout of every single double page spread and what picture was where and what words were where and the exact point that the large font for the story titles came in, because that Radio Times 10th anniversary special is just the most perfect thing in the world. And everyone at school, this is a mark of Doctor Who in the Pertwee era, is that everyone at school had one. I was in a class of 30 people, and all 30 of them had a copy of the Radio Times 10th anniversary special, because that's how important
that's
Doctor Who
amazing.
Was.
That's amazing. That's, yeah, my main memory of it is reading the Terry Nation We Are the Daleks over and over again and just being so thrilled that we are the Daleks. Now I'd be horrified.
And a Frank Hampson piece of artwork, which I was that aware of Dan Dare. But I remember my dad knowing who Frank Hansen was and saying, oh, that's the man that did Dan Dare. And that made me go, oh, what's Dan Dare? Is that something to do with Doctor Who? And so I went out and investigated Dan Dare, and there was a little paperback book you could get with some Dan Dare stuff in it. And I bought that because I thought it was all part of Doctor Who. For years, I firmly believed that Dan Dare was going to bump into the Daleks at some point, because my dad had linked these two things together.
Free on DVD with issue 6 of Warp Warp.
I stopped the car at last and let the fog close in around
me. Brand new animation by Mel.
I knew I was somewhere on Barnes Common, and I had a suspicious idea it was the most deserted part as well.
Adapted from the opening chapter of Doctor Who and the Daleks by David Whittaker.
I'm Barbara. Barbara Wright. Susan. Susan was in the road.
A meeting on the Common.
Oh my goodness.
I say, you there! Are you trying to get us all killed? There's petrol everywhere!
Featuring Stephen Noonan.
What are you doing here?
As the First Doctor. Out now. Order online at warpwarp.co.uk.
Staying in your childhood, we've got Weetabix cards. From 1975.
Yeah, 1975 Weetabix cards. Well, these were obviously the ultimate thing that you had at school. And I used to go every single week, every Saturday. I'm sure my parents didn't need to go shopping every Saturday. But we would go every Saturday into town, into Maidenhead. And there's a big new Tesco that opened up right in the city centre in the middle of the shopping mall. And it was huge to me anyway. It seemed huge. And on the right-hand side, as you walked in, were cereals. And I used to go to the Weetabixes, and I would slide open the boxes and look inside and see which pack of cards were in there. And the moment I found one that I hadn't got, that was the Weetabix. I didn't nick them. That was the Weetabix we bought. But I would open as many packets of Weetabix as I could to make sure I didn't get duplicates. And that's how I got my complete set, was by, you know, say, going to good old Tesco's and slice it, because Weetabix were very, you didn't, it took no elegance or sophistication to open Weetabix. All other cereals are very difficult to open as a kid. Weetabix, they literally pop the tab in. They didn't steal it. So flipping up the tab, opening it, taking the thing up, putting it back in, I'll close that one, open them. So no one knew that all these Weetabixes had been opened because I was very good at closing
them. You did no damage. You didn't like have to rip into them.
I did no damage at all and no theft. I look back now and think, Christ, why didn't you just nick them all and no one would have noticed? No CCTV back in those days. But I was a good, well-brought-up boy and would go to my mum and say, and I always made sure that we bought the Weetabix that was only one thing long, not the doubles. And if they didn't have the one thing long ones and they didn't, because not, I think they did do them in the long, thin ones, but they were also normal Weetabix. It didn't have Doctor Who in them. And I used to get very frustrated if I had to buy a double Weetabix packet. I hated Weetabix. Let's just get that out there. And I still hate Weetabix to this day. But I had to eat this crap as quickly as possible so we could go and buy another one the next week if possible. So it was much easier to get them out of the thin ones, which were only one column of Weetabixes. I could just about manage that in a week. Two columns of Weetabix was ethical and just absolutely gaggingly horrible. But I had to get the set, and I did. And I'm actually, while I'm talking to you now, I have my original set from 1975 in my hands.
I think that's worth a few hundred quid, isn't it?
Well, probably not, because they're all pushed out of their backgrounds and everything, because I used to put them on little stands and play with them. And Blue Peter did a Build Yourself a Doctor Who theatre.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I did that. It was terrible when I did it. They looked beautiful on Blue Peter. I did look like shit. But I used to play with my Yeti and my Quark and my Sal, and the White Robot and all these things that were flooding back to my memory from the Charon era that I had forgotten about until I saw the Weetabix cards. And it's all this, my entire life revolves around nostalgia and bringing nostalgia back into the present day and making, you know, the past exciting because the present really isn't. And then it all starts with this obsession with Doctor Who and Weetabix figures and 10th anniversary specials and annuals of remembering things and realizing that I didn't want to forget stuff that I had forgotten. So I remember those Weetabix figures and couldn't work out for ages who Sal was. When I saw the listing in, I think they advertised it in, and it mentioned Sal, and I thought, I don't remember a monster called the Sal at all. So when Slar turned up with his misspelling, I was like, oh, but that's the Ice Roar. He didn't look like that. He didn't have a cape. I remembered that so clearly. And I'm sure my mum or my dad must have said, well, maybe he did and you've forgotten. And I was very upset that they'd given Sal a cape. And then I thought, well, maybe Sal is an Ice Warrior I've forgotten, because why would they wouldn't make a mistake. I don't recognise the name Sal. And he's got a cape, but he isn't from Curse of Peladon, so he must be from an earlier story. Oh, hang on a minute. There was a story before that one on the moon with the Ice Warriors. Maybe he was in that. And I, for years, decided that was my rationalisation, that Slar was from Seeds of Death, but Sal was clearly an Ice Warrior from the original Ice Warrior stories that I had less of a recollection of. And I was very disappointed when the novel came out to discover that he wasn't in there at all. No cape, no nothing. Gary, you got it wrong. And I thought, oh, no, Weetabix got it wrong. They made the mistake. They used the wrong picture and the wrong name.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were beautiful. And we used to trade them at school. People would come up and say, well, can I have that Tom Baker? I go, no, he's part of a four set. I'm not giving you a Tom Baker. I'd be without a Tom Baker. Well, can I have all four of them then? Well, what are you going to offer me in return? Well, I've got those already. Well, how about this set? No, I've got those already. I did not give things away easily.
No, but for me, as I think I mentioned to you in the real world, but one of my earliest Doctor Who memories is being in the playground and someone having those Weetabix cards. And I didn't have any because my parents, anti-commercial, we always got the, we wouldn't get anything that was the brand name. We'd always get the one that wasn't the brand name. And they certainly wouldn't allow, they were immune to pest and power, my bloody parents. They'd always go to the cheaper petrol station instead of the one that had Smurfs and all these things. Mm-hmm. So we were forever. My brother's got an addiction to Smurfs that he puts down to us not being allowed Smurfs. And everyone at school had Smurfs from the Texaco garage. And my parents were like, no, it's a waste of money. Commercialism. But anyway, but yeah, that's the moment. And this shows how I was probably destined to become a Doctor Who fan. Because obviously I was already watching the show, but I must have been three or four. And I remember seeing one of these and it was the first time I saw John Pertwee, and it said The Doctor next to it, and I was, that's not The Doctor. And that was my first, and somebody said, no, that's what he used to look like. And that was my first, and I just can remember it now, like Brody on the beach in Jaws going, whoa, as my world changed around me. And I also firmly remember just falling in love with Agador there and then. Like, there was a picture of Agador. And so, and then when the, yeah, so that was one of the first Target books that I put my mitts on when I got to see them, because I just knew what Agador was and what Peladon was. Mm-hmm. And that's still some of my favourite Doctor Who is Peladon.
I was convinced as a kid that the Peladon people, when they were on television, all had green skin.
Is that just because of the...
Absolutely convinced.
That's weird, isn't it? Is that kind of...
Yeah, and so when lighting? I was a boy and I got my first edition Curse of Peladon novel, much to the horror of my mum and probably everyone else in the world listening to this, I coloured all the pictures in. And I used to do that with all my Targets, just colour the pictures in. And I coloured all the Peladonian people to be green. And so when Curse of Peladon finally, I got a pirate VHS of it in the early, I don't know, early 80s, I suppose, I suddenly realised, because all the photographs existed were black and white photographs. And I watched it and went, they don't have green skin. Why did I think they had green skin? And I can only assume that, obviously, I knew Alpha Centauri was green, and maybe I projected that onto everyone else. I swore it was green. Alpha Centauri was green. Clearly, the Peladon people must have been green as well. And I was convinced of that as a child, that they were all green.
The memory cheats, as they say.
It does.
But it's a, yeah, no, I love Peladon. And I remember absolutely loving your own novel, set in the Peladon universe, Legacy.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, which I absolutely loved. When we were in Gallifrey a couple of years ago in LA, John Peel came up and he said what I've always said, which is, I learned the word diadem from your book, Legacy.
Really?
In the New Adventures. Because John Peel was saying the same thing, saying, diadem, that's a brilliant word. And I think I probably learnt the word diadem. Every time I see it, I think of the Seventh Doctor about to be executed by an ice warrior on that cover.
That's great. That's how it should be. I learned lots of words from reading Terence Dix's stuff and people like that. I learned the word remnants. I used to have a dictionary beside me in my bedroom. So as I was reading Target books, if something came up I didn't know what it was, I could immediately go to a dictionary and look it up. And I remember coming across the word remnant in Barry Letts's Demons novelization. Bok was blown up and the remnants scattered, and I didn't know what remnants were. I remember looking that up. And I did that quite a few times with those early Targets, that I would go, I don't know what this means. And I'd look it up in the dictionary and go, oh, and that would be a word I would then use myself every 5 minutes. I'd be saying, my mum would be saying, can you clean up those toast crumbs? I go, you mean toast remnants? She'd look at me in a kind of, oh, God, he's been reading Doctor Who books again. Yeah. Facsimile was another one. Or facsimile, as obviously I pronounce it, not knowing how it was supposed to be pronounced. But facsimile, I remember looking that up in the book, because Terence kept referring to the Alton facsimiles, and I was going, I don't know what that means. And these people taught us to read.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. That's about the only sentence I ever got to say to Terence Dix, because I was late to a convention, one of Gareth's conventions, and I was late because of traffic, and Terence was just leaving. So my only time I met Terence Dix is he was getting in a taxi. And I was chatting to Gareth, and I just shook his hand and went, it's such an honour to meet you. Hopefully I'll meet you again. And you taught me to read. And he was like, oh, thank you very much.
It was very nice. Thank you. Thank you.
And then he got in a taxi, and it wasn't to be that I never met him again. But, I must have read more Terence Dix books than any other author. By some bell, I think.
That's true of a lot of us.
Yeah.
But I think we all owe our careers to Terence and Barry Letts and Brian Hales and Malcolm, especially Malcolm Alg in my case. And also, I will say, Bill Strutton, that Doctor Who and the Zabi novelization, which I remember buying in 73, 74, and just going, oh my God, this is fantastic. Because I always knew there were past Doctors. I think this is because I witnessed the regeneration, but also having older brothers, we would always talk about Hartnell and Troughton. So when Pertwee came along, it was, he's the new Doctor Who. So I just accepted automatically that Doctor Who was changing all the time. It was the same man with a different face. So that never confused me. That never threw me at all. But so when I remember walking in and seeing the three Hartnell books of their Chris Achilles covers and just being in love with them and just thinking, yes. And I found The Crusade and The Web Planets would be my favourites. I'm a heathen in that I have never got on with David Whittaker's Doctor Who in an Exciting Adventure with the Daleks on Barnes Common with Everlasting Matches. I think it's brilliant. I look at it as a technical work and just think it's fantastic. And it's got a glass Dalek and all of these things. But it's was never as a kid, it was never one I wanted to ever go back and reread. I only read it about three times as a kid. Whereas the Zabi and the Crusaders, they were on my rotation. I had a rotation. You start with Day of the Daleks, then it's the Doomsday Weapon, then it's the Autumn Invasion, then it's the Sea Devils, then it's the Zabi, then it's the Crusaders, then it's probably the Demons. Oh, and look, another book's come out. And so that would slip into the rotation. And when I'd finish that, I'd go back again to Day of the Daleks and start the rotation again. But I never included Whittaker's original Dalek novelization in my rotation. Occasionally I would go, I have to read it. I haven't read it for at least 6 months. I'll have to read it again. Because I would read a Target novel in a day. You know, as a kid, I'd go to bed early just to read Doctor Who and the Zabi all over again. Oh, those were fantastic days. Fantastic days.
You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics, publisher of creator-owned comics based on characters and stories set in the Doctor Who universe. For more on Cutaway, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.
On to your next choice. I've stuck Carnival of Monsters in here.
So again, we're back to the fact that Pertwee is God. Pertwee has never been bettered as Doctor Who. He's still the best Doctor Who of all time. So if we take that for granted, I had to sit down and think, okay, I've chosen Inferno because it's the best Doctor Who story ever. But then I thought, well, if again I sit down and think, oh, I just want to slap a Doctor Who on for the evening that I can vegetate in front of, and I want to be a Pertwee. Carnival is usually my Doctor Who of choice because it's perfect. Because there's nothing wrong with it. It's a clever story. It's Robert Holmes at his absolute best. It's got thrilling adventures. It's got a bit of sort of gung-ho to it. It's got a bit of pastiche to it. Again, it's not the same as Parallel Worlds, but it has that very clever thing of things are not quite what you think they are. And you think you're on a boat in 1926 and you're not, you're inside a machine. And you're seeing the story from the people outside and the story from the people inside. The Doctor and Joe are absolutely the best they ever are as a team. Completely in sync with each other. When Joe first turns up, the Doctor is quite belittling towards her in a lot of season eight. It's not really until the Demons, well, sort of actually the end of Colony in Space, but certainly the Demons, that he sort of stops being rude to her all the time. And that carries through a little bit into season nine. The Time Monster, Sloman again, goes back to being a little bit of the sort of impatient with Joe. But by season 10, they are absolutely unbeatable as a duo. They are fun to watch. They're fun to follow a story with. So I wanted something that really capitalised my childhood memories of how good Pertwee and Katie Manning were. It's got Drashigs in it, who I think are fantastic. It's got the three grey guys, who are just brilliant. It's got Vorg and Schoner, who are just brilliant. And then it's got Major Daly and his daughter and Captain Andrews. And then there's little cameos by Oberons and Cybermen. You can't do better than that.
Yeah.
I love Carnival of Monsters with a passion.
Yeah.
It's got a very silly dinosaur coming out of the sea.
Yeah.
But you know what? When I was a kid, it didn't strike me as a silly dinosaur. The only thing it did make me slightly confused as a kid, and I think my brother had to explain, but the thing that came out of the sea and the Drashigs were different.
Yeah.
Because you know, well, you never see the thing comes out of the sea more than once.
This is a strange
thing,
isn't it? And when the Drashigs
turn up two episodes later, there's no photographs. You have no one to turn around and go, no, that was a dinosaur. This is a thing with three eyes on its head. I just thought, oh, that's that thing that came out of the sea. And my brother kind of went, no, it's not. It's a different monster entirely.
My Carnival of Monsters for me was one of my favourite novelisations. And that's got the... That's got the sort of sea serpent plesiosaur on the front, hasn't it?
Yes.
Coming at, but looking slightly better than it did in the TV.
Well, probably because Chris O'Kelly sat down and went, I'm going to look up, see what a plesiosaur actually looks like. And went, oh, it looks a bit like that. Okay. And of course, that novel came out, unlike the TV show, but the novelization came out at the height of your Doug McClure's people at the end of, I was going to say at the Earth's core, but it's the other ones, the land that time forgot, the people that time forgot.
Yeah, yeah.
The dinosaurs coming out and all of this sort of stuff. And that book cover comes out at, right in the middle of that sort of era of Doug McClure films. So it's a very clever cover, because actually that plesiosaur is in the show for about 10 seconds. It's not an important part of the storytelling of Carnival of the Monsters, but as a book cover to sell to kids, you slap a dinosaur on the front attacking a boat and they go, oh, I saw that Saturday morning at the cinema with Doug McClure. So they go out and buy the novel. I thought that was a very smart move by Chris and his art for a time.
It might be why it's one of the few ones I was allowed to buy. There's that one and Invasion of the Dinosaurs. So, yeah, so the power of dinosaurs.
Absolutely. All kids love dinosaurs. Any child that doesn't love dinosaurs needs an education.
Yeah, well, all my kids love dinosaurs. And I could.
Yeah, but your kids also like drowning people on boats.
Well, they do, yeah. And
that's worrying. That's slightly worrying.
Well, if you can see behind me, the Titanic that we bought him, the Lego Titanic. He loves Titanic, so
I know.
Family got that for you may have seen on Facebook, but yeah, we got that for him. £600 of Lego in money, that is. But yeah, so I hadn't actually watched Carnival of Monsters for well over a decade. So I watched it last night and finished this morning, and it's absolutely, like you say, it's absolutely wonderful. Just so many. It's got a sort of base under siege vibe mixed with really cool sci-fi, mixed with weird grey people, the people of Interminer. And it's full of Doctor Who royalty as well, because you've got Ian Marta, who would later be Harry Sullivan, of course, being brilliant. And you've got Michael Wisher.
Well, you've got Michael Wisher, Terence Lodge and Peter Halliday. You just don't get better than that for that. It's just brilliant. But you know what? What's most important, I think, of all about Carnival of the Monsters and why it's such a good story to watch over and over again is that it is constant fun. It is Doctor Who doing what it does best. Saturday tea time, 25 minutes, absolute fun. There is no point where you yawn. There is no point where you go, what is going on? I don't care about this.
No longer.
You know, this is from an era where people knew how to make fun Doctor Who for 25
Holmes
minutes.
Hulk. So Holmes, Letts, Dix as the script editor, Pertwee, Manning, and all those amazing. I mean, it really is just, yeah, it never lets up.
Yeah, it's just fantastic.
Maybe it's because I've sort of because we've done this Hinchcliffe book, so I've started that part of my brain that digs in and gets slightly over intellectualized as Doctor Who episodes, having had to write essays about it for the book you're editing. But part of me thought, you know, because it has some. The characters in 1926 have some choice, slightly outmoded, Johnny Chinaman.
Of course, talking, yes.
Which is brilliant. Which is,
they're the cooks of Madrassi.
Yeah, I find the Madrassi lazy. But, yes. But part of me thought, A, it's kind of fine because these people are pompous and of their time anyway. But I also wonder if the fact that on the outside, you've got the people treating these people who are racist in their own way as less animals.
Of course.
So is that deliberate?
That's what Holmes does so brilliantly. He's a clever parallel writer. Everything he does. It's also a rare case of it's a Doctor Who story by Holmes that doesn't have that kind of duo to sit and tell us the story.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you've got Vaughan and Schoener, but they're not telling us the story. They're not. There's no observational stuff about the story, and I think that's quite nice.
Yeah.
And you know, everyone's got distinct characters. Oh, it's just wonderful and fun, and I now want to watch it again.
Yeah, and as a little artifact from that time, the fact it's, you can just sort of feel Holmes' own life in there. It's got National Service that Vaughan refers to, the 14th Heavy Lasers. It's so of its time in such a brilliant way. But I just thought, I just enjoyed it so thoroughly, and I was just grinning from ear to ear. And then right at the end, that last frame, when the TARDIS disappears, And you have Cheryl Hall just grinning because the TARDIS has disappeared. And I just thought, God, my God, you could probably write an essay on how that image sums up the joy of Doctor Who.
Yes, absolutely.
Her character's so wonderful. She's so optimistic. And then right at the end, she's like, oh, I love the universe. Look, it's got that in it. It's just such a...
Well, I'll tell you this. We didn't know, well, I certainly didn't know as a kid, that this was Katie Manning's last season.
Mm.
I remember when she left at the end of Green Death, being taken completely and utterly by surprise. And, you know, thinking she and the looking at Carnival, and the three doctors, and it's like they're here forever. Mm. You know, what? And then when she left, you're like, well, she can't leave. She's Jo Grant. She's been in Doctor Who for 25 years now. You know,
yeah.
I've grown up with Jo Grant. How can you possibly leave?
The Green Death's always. I always point youngsters who haven't watched much classic. I think they assume the old show was fun and good, but didn't do proper story things like the modern show. And then I just go, well, go and watch the end of Green Death, and then that sort of converts them to realizing the writing was often amazing as we know it is, of course, but it's sometimes a bit of a shock to people who think, oh, classic Who, well, it's obviously it's of its time and I won't watch it, I'll just concentrate on 2005 onwards. But the end of the Green Death being genuinely moving and making your bottom lip quiver
and selling you a message as well. It's 70s Doctor Who was brilliant.
Something's coming, a threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you.
Gods and Monsters, Issue 1, Faustine, written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh, written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And Issue 3, Omega, El Trella, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space.
So on from the Carnival of Monsters, I guess I kind of wanted to talk to you about Big Finish, and I guess now before your final choice, Big Finish, which I'm now officially a writer of, which is just amazing after 20 years. I think it was because I interviewed Rob Sherman the other day, and I said the first ever one was somebody said you've got to listen to Deadline, and so it was that sort of tapping into the niche, not just the continuity of the show, but the behind the scenes that really got me into Big Finish. And I've since spent probably more money than I want to think about on Big Finish. Like, I've never missed an episode of the Paul McGann Doctor by Big Finish, and that alone is probably a small mortgage. So it's just just an amazing thing. But how did it, I guess you've probably told this story many times, but just I think it's just quite amazing. Like, how did it come about with you and Jason Haigh-Ellery in 98, was it?
No. Jason and I went to the BBC in 96, just after I'd done the TV movie novelization. We went in and said, can we get the rights to do Doctor Who on audio? And they said no. And then they called us back Benny's 25 years this year, so 98 they called us back in and said, you know, would you like to we must have gone to see them at the very beginning of 97 because it was exactly a year. So I think we went to see them again in March 98, and they told us they'd got this great idea for doing Doctor Who on audio. Like, okay, that was our idea, but never mind. And they offered us a license, and we bit their hands off. I bit their hands off because I wasn't paid for it, and Jason was. So I've always said, you know, my greatest joy in life is spending Jason's money for him, and his greatest mistake in life is letting me. But yeah, and that was really the start of Big Finish. We'd done the Bennies, and then suddenly we got the gift to be able to do proper Doctor Who with the original actors. And that was amazing. And that was a case of just perseverance, really. Perseverance and going out and not... Once we've been told no once, we said, right, we're going to do something else then to show that we can do it and to show them we know what we're talking about. And we did. And then they came to us, which is the most flattering thing in the world, and said, would you like Doctor Who? And we said yes. And off we went and we did Sirens of Time. And proved then... You know, once we proved to the BBC we could do it with the Benny stuff, we then had to prove to the world of Doctor Who that we could do it with Sirens of Time.
Yeah.
Because there was a gap of 2 months between Sirens of Time and Phantasmagoria, and another gap of 2 months between Phantasmagoria and Whispers of Terror. And then we went monthly after that. So it was the hardest sell wasn't the BBC and it wasn't the actors. The hardest sell was to fandom, to convince them that this was something new. They had the Virgin books. They had the BBC books by then. They'd had years of comics. You'd had every, you know, the only other thing they'd had on audio was the Pescatons. and most of them hadn't listened to it and had preferred to read the novel. So we had an uphill struggle in trying to convince Doctor Who fandom that audio was an interesting new way of enjoying brand new Doctor Who stories. And it took a while. I think it took at least 6 weeks before we realised that this had been a success. I mean, Sirens of Time literally set the world alight, and we were like, oh, people like this. And then when Phantasmagoria came out, and I think having Mark's name attached to it didn't hurt us, and we were there. And people were already talking about how can we subscribe to this. We didn't have subscriptions at first, I don't think. I think the first time we offered a subscription started with Whispers of Terror, because we suddenly thought, oh, hang on a minute, this isn't going to be six people and a cat buying this at a convention. People are writing and saying, we want to be able to pre-order these things. This is you're going to be here. So boom. And it was a joy, absolute joy, to realize that we had done something and we'd found something that people wanted. Never mind the fact that we wanted to do it, that people wanted to listen to it and people wanted to take it seriously. And that was fantastic. And then I carried on doing that for the next 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, it's just, it's a phenomenon, isn't it? And still going.
But now it's this huge empire. I mean, Nick has worked so hard to build it into this fantastic, gargantuan empire.
Yeah.
I couldn't have done that. I don't have the nouts or, frankly, the interest in making that much, those many different ranges and that much product.
Yeah.
I think it's astonishing that they've gone ahead and done this and made it so successful. Yeah. From this tiny little acorn that you know, Jason and I, and he's still there now, obviously, mm-hmm. but Jason and I planted this tiny acorn and thought we might get a little bit of a shrub for a few years, and Nick has created an orchard.
Banyan tree.
Fantastic.
Yeah, just, we wouldn't have, you know, we wouldn't.
There are lots of things we wouldn't have if it wasn't for Big Finish. I don't think people realise that. I always say, you know, it all goes back to Paul Cornell and Peter Darblevins. We wouldn't have anything mm-hmm. if it wasn't for the two of them.
Yeah.
But I think there's an awful lot of things people wouldn't have if it wasn't for Big Finish. And a lot of episodes of the TV shows since it's come back, we probably wouldn't have.
Yeah, that first season, I mean, Russell really did. And one of the best things about, well, many great things about Russell, but he is first and foremost a fan of the show he was bringing back, just like you guys were fans of the show doing Big Finish, just like the people doing Virgin New Adventures were fans of the show first and foremost. And you make something for yourself that then translates into lots of other people like it. But, you know, but the fact that there were so many sort of people who started with the New Adventures or with Big Finish in that first season speaks absolute volumes to the quality of the stuff that, you know, you guys did in that period. And on this show, stuff from that period is on people's top five lists of things they want to take in the bunker with them. So I've been re-listening to loads of that era of Big Finish. Sirens of Time just the other day, I re-listened to for the first time in a long, long time. And it's, what's great about it is it's so fresh. Absolutely brilliant. I mean, I think one of the big things was when you got McGann. For me, he's now, I'd say, probably almost my favorite Doctor. And obviously, most of his content is Big Finish. And I just think, you know, what was it like when you got McGann?
Joy. Absolute joy and panic as well. Because, you know, I knew Colin, Sylvester and Peter for years. So working with them was fun. Paul was an unknown quantity and we didn't know what to expect. I mean, he certainly didn't know what to expect, but he was fun right from the word go. And it was a success and he loved it and he wanted to do more. And that was all I could ever ask for. It was that Paul McGann enjoyed himself and wanted to do more. Imagine how awful it would have been if we'd done that first season of McGann's and that had been it. What would that say about us? That you know, oh, you got Paul McGann and then he told you to piss off. But he didn't. He said his thing on the Friday after that, end of the first week, was, when are we doing some more of these then? And it was like, yes, we've done it. That's fantastic. We've won him over.
You have done so much, Gary. It's amazing. It really is. Just your CV is, we haven't even mentioned the animations. And all those things and your time in Australia and all the other things. I mean, it's pretty amazing, but we don't want to make this a 5-hour podcast. So your final choice.
My final choice is a weird one. I mean, it's not a weird story because it's one of the very best Doctor Who stories of all time. But I, as you may have gathered, I'm a massive John Pertwee fan.
Yeah.
And then he stopped being Doctor Who and he was replaced by this man with a scarf and a hat and curly hair and big eyes. And I hated him. Absolutely loathed Tom Baker's Doctor as a kid. Absolutely despised it. I was watching, Scott Hancock and I were watching Seeds of Doom a couple of nights back. And I said to Scott, I remember this so clearly. This was the first story where I accepted that Doctor Who was now played by Tom Baker. It had taken that long for me to get over my general antipathy towards him. Loved all the stories, but I hated him as Doctor Who because he wasn't perfect. But it wasn't until this next choice of mine where I really went, okay, I think I'm willing to say that I'm now once again a proper fan of Doctor Who. I have accepted that Tom Baker is going to be the Doctor Who for a while. And that's Robots of Death. And the reason Robots of Death is so good is, other than that, it's just got an amazing story and an amazing script. But I do believe that Robots of Death is one of probably two stories from that era that if someone who had never seen Doctor Who came to your house and said, all right, you're a massive fan of this show, show me a Doctor Who story to make me fall in love with the show. And I would go to my shelves and go, right, for all my love of Pertwee, for all my love of everything else, the first two things I'd take off the shelf would be Terror of the Zygons and The Robots of Death, because I think they work as something you could introduce a complete stranger to Doctor Who, and they will go away knowing what Doctor Who is. And the reason I would take Robots of Death into the bunker is it's probably the story that I have watched more than any other story in the entire history of Doctor Who. It is absolutely my all-time go-to, chill out, watch, put on the telly. I know every line of dialogue. I know every breath that each individual character makes. It is fantastic. But what tips it over for me as a Tom Baker story into the best Tom Baker story is that it has Leela. And I love Sarah Jane and I love Harry and I, you know, can cope with Romana and all of that. But Leela is my Tom Baker companion. She's the one I think works best with him. And it's such a shame that she's there for such a short space of time. And Robots of Death is her, is Louise Jameson, who is one of the greatest actresses ever to be in Doctor Who. It is her at her absolute best because she deals with Tom Baker's weird mannerisms and scattiness. And she carries the show. Every scene she's in, even when she's in a scene with Tom, it's carried by Louise Jameson. And Leela is a brilliant creation. And Robots of Death is a clever, clever story. What's naughty about it and so unusual for Doctor Who and so unusual for drama generally is it's a rare case and breaks all the rules in that you as a viewer are supposed to work with the Doctor to find out what's going on. And you know before the Doctor's even arrived on the Sandminer that the robots are the killers. And as a viewer, you're sitting there playing catch up, going, come on, Doctor, all the clues are there. And then the Doctor starts to get it and nobody else does. And you're going, no, listen to the Doctor. We know he's right because we've seen the robots do the murders. And it's a very, very unusual episode of Doctor Who and a very unusual episode of drama to not only attempt to do that, but to get away with it so brilliantly.
Yeah, but it's built like a horror film, isn't it, in that regard?
Yes, it's a horror film where you've seen the murder in the first 5 minutes. You know, as I say, the Doctor and Leela haven't even arrived on the Sandminer, and we know the robots are the killers. It's fantastic. It's such a brave form of storytelling that nobody else really bothers to do in Doctor Who at that era. Doctor is the greatest find that Hinchcliffe and Holmes ever
had. It adds tension to every scene because you know.
You're going, come on, work it out.
So it's absolute genius. But yeah, I mean, as you'll know from my essay on for the Hinchcliffe book, I absolutely think Leela, when anyone says, who's your favourite Doctor Who companion? I just say Leela. No shade to anyone else because they're all brilliant in their own way, but just without any hesitation, Louise Jameson. I mean, I've been lucky enough to work with her on a couple of things now, and she's just a brilliant actor. And I mean, you've worked with her on a million things, haven't you?
Well, but for me personally, more importantly, I met Lou on her very first day on Doctor Who.
Oh, wow.
Because I was doing Phoenix on the Carpet in Studio 2 at Ealing, and she was doing The Face of Evil in Studio 1 at Ealing. And everyone on the production knew I was a massive Doctor Who fan. And so they said, do you want to meet the new Doctor Who companion? And at that point, I'm not sure I even knew that there was going to be a new Doctor Who companion, but I was like, yes. And her dressing room was like two doors down from my dressing room. And we knocked on the door. Lou got out of a bath to meet me and sign an autograph for me. And we chatted, and years and years later, we were doing a convention and I was interviewing her and I mentioned this story and she was like, oh my God, that was you. And we've been friends ever since.
Yeah,
because I was the first person to ever ask her for an autograph. It was on her very first day on Face of Evil. And she was running around the forests of Ealing Studios.
Brilliant. Yeah, and she's absolutely wonderful. It's great that she's I've been watching Emmerdale. I've got to say Emmerdale Farm. That's how much I don't usually watch Emmerdale. I've been watching Emmerdale.
Your age, she's in it
on and off. But yeah, just absolutely wonderful. Brilliant actor. I've got her in as a sort of villain in my horror thing, with Colin and Peter in it as well. So which is we're just sort of finishing the edit off and that, and she's absolutely brilliant. Just as everyone knows, but yeah, she is so nice and great to work with. As are you, Gary. You are.
I don't really think you can put me quite on the same level as Louise Jameson.
You are lovely, and many people that is. owe you a lot in terms of their starts or legs up and all that sort of stuff in the business. So it's
no one owes me anything. I hate the word owe. Nobody owes me anything.
I mean.
I was just in a lucky position that I had the opportunity to give a number of people with Bone. I was working at DWM and then later at Big Finish and then later in Cardiff on the show, the opportunity to give people that leg up. But it's not a case. They don't owe me anything. They just were brilliant and the right people at the right time. But and if it hadn't been me that found them, somebody else.
You're so self-deprecating, Gary, but we'll leave it at that because you don't like being the centre of attention.
I'm going to go back now and read my Doctor Who 1969 annual and hug it.
Oh, lovely! And I might go and watch a bit more Pertwee. Now I've got the bug.
Yes, I think everybody should go and watch every, with the exception of Claws of Axos. No one should ever have to watch Claws of Axos.
Yes, it's a funny one, that, isn't it?
The only Pertwee that I think is bad.
Anyway, Gary Russell, it has been a pleasure to do this chat.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Well, that's of course. It's because I owe you so much, but I probably should give Marvel UK their 40 quid back, but
yeah, right.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton, produced by James Stevenson of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.